are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Set in jazz age San Diego against the backdrop of yellow journalism, notorious Hollywood scandals, prohibition, corruption, and a lively culture war, Mystery at the Blue Sea Cottage tells the intriguing true crime story of a beautiful dancer, a playboy actor, and a debonair doctor. In January 1923, 20-year-old Fritzy Mann left home for a remote cottage by the sea to meet a man whose identity she had revealed to no one. The next morning, the barely clad body of the beautiful and bewitching dancer washed up on a lonely Torrey Pines beach, her party dress and possessions strewn about on the sand. The scene baffled investigators. Was it suicide, murder, or an accidental drowning? A botched autopsy created more questions than it answered. However, the investigation revealed a scandalous secret and possibly a powerful motive for murder. After a suspect was arrested and charged with murder, an ambitious district attorney battled a high-profile L.A. private counsel in the most sensational trial in San Diego's history that was followed avidly across the nation. The big question? What really happened at the Blue Sea Cottage? The book we're featuring this evening is Mystery at the Blue Sea Cottage, a true story of murder in San Diego's jazz age, with my special guest, journalist and author, James Stewart. Welcome to the program, and thank you for this interview, James Stewart.
Hi, Dan. It's my pleasure. Glad to be here.
It's our pleasure. Thank you so much. This is a incredible historical story. Let's get right to, when did you first learn about Fritzy Mann's story, and how?
Well, in 2012, I had decided to get an MFA in creative writing. I had always wanted to go back to school and do that. And the first thing I decided I needed was a thesis topic, obviously, when you're in an MFA program. So I wanted to write a narrative nonfiction kind of book. And I was looking around for a true crime from the past, just because that's my favorite kinds of true crime stories, and always has
right.
been. And so I started looking, and I asked around town here various people, and a number of people mentioned this story. And I went to the San Diego History Center, and the young woman who worked there, as soon as I mentioned it, she says, "Oh, San Diego's Black Dahlia case," is what she called it. And
wow.
A lot of people were talking about it back then. And what had happened was, is the year before, I think it was 2011, a local historian and author named Richard Crawford had written a piece about it in the San Diego Union. And he often wrote on, you know, on historical topics. And he kind of resurrected this story from, you know, the dustbin of history, I guess you could say. And it kind of became known around town. And especially, you know, in the historical societies, libraries, places like that, because everybody seemed to have heard of it when I asked about it. And you know, I needed something that you could find enough information on, because when you're talking about now a 100-year-old, you know, obscure murder mystery, where
right.
do you get the information for that? And so I decided that it needed to be a case that had gone to trial so that hopefully I could find trial transcripts, and I did in this case, and had been widely covered in the newspapers because that gives you, you know, a lot of your other information. So this was one of the only ones I found that really met all my criteria, although there were some other interesting stories from back then. None of them were nearly as fascinating as this case was. So I took it and started doing the research and started my MFA program, and this was my thesis project.
Now, you write in early in the book that this is a considered what we mentioned in the title, in the synopsis about the Jazz Age, and you say that it was considered one of the most fascinating eras in U.S. history. Tell us a little bit about what characterized the Jazz Age, what was the buzz, or what they were talking about, or issues of the Jazz Age.
Yeah, I knew a little bit about it. I had read about it, but I didn't know as much as I found out when I started researching this book. And what happened was after the Great War, World War I, there was kind of a change in society, and especially the younger set were kind of disillusioned, and it kind of became with a devil may care kind of attitude, a party attitude, because you might be dead, tomorrow from another war. So there was kind of that attitude, let's party. But at the same time, the traditionalists were trying to rein in all of that newfound liberalism, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. And so there was a big culture clash at that time, which looks a whole lot like the one that's going on now.
Right.
And then, at the same time, or right around that time, you have Prohibition coming in. So, while you have the young people and just about everybody else wanting to party, theoretically it's illegal, right? Mm-hmm. But so you have the big impact of Prohibition, which had on society. It was huge. It's probably the single biggest thing, especially for a case like this. Because it brought all the corruption with it, and that was right. Certainly true in San Diego as it was in all the big cities. I kind of was drawn to this story as well because San Diego, usually when you read a story about a crime, a historical crime, especially from the 20s, it's usually Chicago, New York. That's where most of the stories come from.
Right.
So, I thought this was interesting because it was a relatively small town then, rather provincial, off the beaten track, if you will. It's only about 80,000 people or so in the city itself. So that was another thing that drew me to it. And the thing that was kind of unique about San Diego during the Prohibition was that it was a border town, a seaport, a tourist town, and a military town all rolled into one. So that really complicated the law enforcement aspect during Prohibition and just added to the corruption, really. The other thing is that impacted society more than it does now even is Hollywood. I didn't really understand about silent Hollywood and how big the stars were and how influential mm-hmm. they were. And, in 1920, half the public went to the movies every week. And by 1930, that was about 75 or 80%. So it was huge. I mean, it's what was around then, with the movies. And so they had a huge impact on popular culture. So, and it also, it, along with corruption and the culture war and some of these other things, they kind of shaped the Fritzy Mann case, just as it did society's, obviously.
Yeah, you talked about these, we don't have time to go in them, but you do, in the book, about scandals surrounding Hollywood that brought down some huge movie stars at that time, like Fatty Arbuckle, huge stars in Hollywood, and fed into the press and society's denunciation of Hollywood and its debauchery, didn't it?
Yes, very much so. Hollywood was a big part of the culture war. Conservatives were, especially after these scandals got started, with Olive Thomas dying in 1920. She was in the original movie called The Flapper, so she was the original movie flapper, if you will. And then in 1921, Fatty Arbuckle. The following year was William Desmond Taylor murder, the biggest murder mystery in Hollywood history. And then there was others. And so that was, this was widely covered in the papers. It was the age of yellow journalism. So, William Randolph Hearst newspapers like the L.A. Examiner and the San Francisco Examiner really hyped the cases, starting with the Arbuckle case and then continuing into William Desmond Taylor murder. And then the following year, right around the same time that Fritzy died, one of the biggest movie stars on the planet at the time, Wallace Reed, died from complications to drug addiction. So that was another huge scandal. So you had the conservatives in Washington that were threatening to shut down Hollywood, basically, yeah. And, you know, just flame spraying them from the floors of Congress for how debauched everything was. And, of course, you know, of course there's a lot of partying going on, but it's nowhere near as it was portrayed in the, you know, the yellow papers of the day, as it were. And, you know, with coming right on the heels of this, the series of scandals, it kind of paved the way for the success, if you will, of the Fritzy Mann story, because there was all these Hollywood connections to the story, and some of them real, some of them imagined, and some of them just hyped by the papers. And but, you know, it's one of the things that really made the story blow up. So Hollywood at the time was a fascinating impact on the culture.
You talk about San Diego, too. If I'm correct, it was about 80,000 people, and it was considered a backwater, so it was not a big place. L.A. was the place to be. Let's get to Freda Mann, her brother William, her mother Amelia, and you had mentioned Flapper, but let's talk about 1922 and what Freda Mann, we mentioned her nickname Fritzy, but what was she known for? What was she aspiring to be? And tell us a little bit about just where she came from and her background.
Right. Fritzy came from an immigrant Jewish family, just like millions of others at the time. They had come over. They actually had settled in Bosnia, Sarajevo, Bosnia, and came to the States 1910. They followed some other family members who had come some years before. And it was her father's name, Esor, and her mother, Amalia, but she went by Amelia as soon as she got to the States, basically, and during this case. Her older brother, William, who was 24 at the time all this happened. Her older sister, Helen, who was dying of tuberculosis and did, in fact, die later in 1923. And then Fritzy at age 20. They had moved originally to Denver. They came to Denver after her father, Esor, died in 1921. Oh, he died in 20. They came to San Diego in 21. And Fritzy had been trained by a classical ballerina named Domina Marini, who is completely forgotten now. But she was actually a protege and danced with Anna Pavlova, you know, arguably the most famous ballerina of all time. Right. And so Fritzy trained with her when she was a teenager, appeared in some of her mentor's dance shows and whatnot in Denver. And then she moved to San Diego with her family. And the reason they moved was because of Helen's tuberculosis. They had originally moved to Denver to because it was known as kind of the world sanitarium, and the high altitude dry air was supposed to be good for you know, consumption, as they call the disease then. Well, obviously, Esor died, so it didn't save him, and so Amelia wanted to see if she could save her daughter, Helen, and San Diego also had that reputation, the only difference being it was at sea level and it was right on the ocean, so you had the breezes as well as the dry desert air, so that's why they came. And then Fritzy started basically right away. They got here late in 1921, and then early in January of 22, she had her first San Diego performance, and most likely, as far as I could tell, probably her first solo performance, which was at one of the major theaters in San Diego called the Colonial. There were 1,400 people there on opening night. Mm-hmm. It was a program that ran a whole week. And then for the rest of 1922, she appeared in a number of, some of them large and some of them small venues, but all over the city. She just took the work wherever she could get it. Her style was called interpretive dancing, which you rarely hear that term anymore. But it was a big deal back then, because when you think of dancers like Isadora Duncan, who mostly performed in Europe, and Ruth St. Denis, who was really the biggest one here in the States around this time. So that was, Fritzi's style was very much in that kind of tradition, where you did a lot of Asian and Middle Eastern kind of ethnic legends and that sort of thing. So and they tried to physically translate that into dance. I mean, that was the idea behind it. And but in some quarters, they tended to have flimsier outfits than traditional in dancing, and a lot of traditionalists thought that it was sort of obscene almost. In some quarters, interpretive dancing, they called it pejoratively oriental dancing, a word we don't use anymore, but back then that was the word they used, and whenever you heard that, it was pretty much pejorative, meaning kind of sleazy. But it wasn't that at all. But that was the way it came across to some people.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's get to Amelia. She doesn't really understand her daughter and her rebellious nature in her mind. And there, she has met this Jewish doctor, soft-spoken Jewish doctor, she remarked. But also she had met this actor who just came by in his, and this was an incredible car at the time, this Marmon, a 1919, so a brand new car, really a fancy car that exuded his wealth, but he wouldn't come into the house, he would just honk for her and she would come out. So she had met these two people, and there were other suitors, as you write. But let's get to January 8th, 1923. And after she's been performing in Los Angeles for 2 months, you talk about a midnight train ride to San Diego dressed like a flapper. Tell us about this incident with her mom beforehand, walking her to the streetcar, her premonition, everything.
Right. She returned on the morning of 8 January 1923 to San Diego on the midnight train from Long Beach. She had been in the L.A. area, at least telling her family that she was performing, and it appears she did perform some, and she visited friends, and she was up to some other stuff that didn't come out until much later that really is at the heart of the story. But when she arrived home that morning, Monday morning, her mother was kind of flabbergasted to see the way she dressed when she walked in. She was in this really nice outfit, a brown silk crepe fringed with copper beads, a party dress, but a really nice one. And, a whole outfit that went along with that. And she rode the midnight train home like that. Her mother just kind of went crazy. She says, "Where did you get this outfit, basically?" And she had borrowed it from her friend in Long Beach. Why she wore it on the train overnight, nobody knows. But her mother got mad at her and said, "Why are you wearing your friend's nice clothes, overnight on the train? You mess them up." And she put them away, basically, and said, "Wear your own damn clothes." So yeah. That was how I started the prologue there. And she was acting strange. That was the first sign that something was going on with Fritzi. And then the rest of the week she acted strange, a number of different things. The most notable one is she kept talking about a man from L.A. was going to take her to a house party in Del Mar, which is a city just up the coast there from San Diego. But she wouldn't give her mother any details, wouldn't tell her the man's name, wouldn't say where it was very vague about everything. But she kept mentioning it for Sunday night, so, almost a week after she arrived. So her mother knew something was going on. There's some question exactly how much her mother knew and her brother about her situation at the time, but they knew she had been in some troubles. And her mother got very worried based on her behavior and the fact that she was being so vague and evasive, basically, about what she was up to. And she kept telling her mother not to worry. Her mother walked with her to the streetcar, which was a block or two away. And she just, again and again, said, don't worry. She got on the streetcar and headed toward downtown San Diego. And about 15 minutes later, she called her mother and said the party wasn't going to be in Del Mar. It was going to be in La Jolla, which is also just north of San Diego there on the coast, a resort town. And but her mother was still worried. But Fritzy tried to allay her fears by saying it's a quiet place. Well, she was up to something, obviously. And she had told her family that she would be back the next day or would call, you know, from this house party. And when she didn't show up the next day, they were very worried. And she didn't show up all day Monday. And then on Tuesday, there was a newspaper article about a body that had been found on the beach in near Del Mar, on Torrey Pines Beach, actually. It was kind of a out-of-the-way place then. And the way that the way her body was discovered was a man and his family were on a trip to San Diego, just a pleasure trip, apparently, and they stopped by for a picnic lunch on Torrey Pines Beach. And then a little boy, 9 years old, went down there and found the body and told his father. And then they called the cops, and that was how the whole thing got started. And the next day, they identified her body at the funeral home.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these commercials. Now, her body has been found. Tell us about the condition. Police, now obviously they're alerted to this crime scene. How do they find her body? What are the conditions right away? And again, the coroner is going to come, Shuler, Kelly. But what do they find at the beach in terms of evidence, and what is her condition?
Right. Well, they were baffled by the crime scene. If it was a crime scene, that was part of the problem. You know, what had happened to her? You know, when you first see somebody wash up on the beach in San Diego, it's an accidental drowning. But that made no sense based on the way she was dressed and the way the posture of her body and some other factors. Her things were kind of strewn all over the place. At the bottom of the embankment going down to where her body was out there on the beach was her party dress, which looked like it had been kind of drug across the dry sand. And then later they found some of her other articles about 500 yards to the south at the bottom of the embankment, again, as if they had been thrown out of the car,
right,
and, of a moving car. And so they were pretty baffled by that. And they that was a handbag and a vanity case. And inside of the vanity case, trying to figure out who this person was, they found a white handwritten card that said, "I am Fritzy Mann," and gave an address, which actually was their old address.
Right.
And the other thing that was strange about the scene was that her body was in an unusual posture for a drowning victim. She was dressed only in a pink silk teddy, stockings, and pumps, and that was it. And mm-hmm. she was on her back with her feet close together and her arms across her body. And it looked to some people like she had been posed there, you know, with her arms. And some people even said that her arms were neatly crossed, you know, like a Sleeping Beauty kind of pose. Basically, everything about the crime scene, people disagreed on what they saw later, but her
right.
posture was unusual. So, you know, right away they were stumped. Was this a suicide? Did she wade out into the ocean? Did somebody kill her and dump her there, you know, especially since that her stuff was dumped out of a moving car heading south? Looks like a panic, maybe. You know, or did she go for a night, midnight swim? Did she get, drunk and, go out for a swim? Which nobody really thought that was it. But it really came down to suicide or homicide. And that actually remained in question until the end of the case and beyond. So how exactly did she die? And was it murder or suicide? And what was her exact cause of death?
You talked about they found a little bruise over one of her eyes, which could indicate many things. But what was interesting is the police response to this card that said, "I am, in the vanity case of likely this woman, I am Fritzy Mann, and here is my address." And so they contacted William, the older brother. He was about 24 years old at that age, at that time. Tell us, though, how, despite this communication between William, the brother, and Kelly, the coroner, there was still confusion as to who this victim was.
Yeah, so that was the next, the next kind of mystery. They couldn't figure out who she was. And even though a deputy sheriff had found that case with that in there, and there was actually a photograph in the case that very much resembled Fritzy, he later that evening, he reported it to the coroner of what he had found that evening. And her body had been taken to a funeral home, which is what they did back then. And the coroner's name was Schuyler Kelly. It looks like Schuyler, S-H-U-Y-L-E-R, but I understand it's pronounced Schuyler. Okay. I'm not 100% certain about that because they never said during the case, but I have been told that, and based on my research, that's the way it was pronounced. But anyway, the deputy sheriff, read off what was in the, to him over the phone, what was in the vanity case. And then I guess he found Fritzy Mann's, address, phone number, called up William. And basically they had a very peculiar conversation he just asked, was she home? Was, Fritzy Mann at home? And her brother said, no, we don't know where she is. And, she's already been missing, since the previous evening at this time. This is on Monday evening. So when William, got a little alarmed by it, he asked the guy, who is this? And he never identified himself as the coroner, apparently. And he just said, this is Kelly, and hung up. And William didn't know what was going on. So there was kind of a mix-up there. So they didn't identify her until the next morning. In fact, William is the one that went after reading a newspaper article in the San Diego Union, I believe, and went and identified her body.
Mm-hmm. You introduce San Diego Police Chief James Patrick to the story, and he kept tight control of this case and conducted most of the important interviews and interrogations personally. And you say that a suspect on Tuesday, this occurred on Sunday, walked into the chief's office with a friend, Dr. Lewis L. Jacobs, a physician. Tell us about this interaction and who Dr. Jacobs was, and what do you have to say?
Yeah, right. Technically, I guess you could say he was kind of the second person of interest, but at the time he walked in the chief's office on Tuesday afternoon, the chief hadn't even heard of him yet. That morning when Amelia went to the funeral home and saw her daughter's body on the, there in the morgue, she screamed the guy's name. It was Rogers Clark, killed my beautiful little girl. Rogers Clark was this actor that she had dated the previous fall. And so he kind of became the first, person of interest there just because her mother thought he had done it. She did not like him. And then on Tuesday afternoon, before the police even knew he existed, this doctor, he actually was, he happened to specialize in the treatment of tuberculosis, which was a huge disease then. And he worked at the VA hospital on Camp Kearney, which was basically a leftover army base from that had been built during World War One, and he walked into the chief's office with a friend of his, a guy named Leo Greenbaum, who was kind of a respected businessman around town. He owned a grocery store of some sort, and he told the story that, you know, Leo Greenbaum tells the chief, you know, earlier today, this guy, meaning Louis Jacobs, my friend, walked into my store holding the newspaper and basically said he wanted to call his lawyer. Now, why he told the chief this, I don't know, because it made the chief instantly, you know, suspicious, because here's this guy, the cops don't even know about him yet. He just shows up with this friend of his, and his friend says he wanted to see a lawyer. Well, he's already trying to lawyer up, and they didn't even know who he was. So the chief was suspicious. And then as he kind of, they talked there, it wasn't a formal interview, obviously, but Louis Jacobs basically said, she was a friend of mine, I want to help you clear up the mystery of what happened to her. He claimed he hadn't seen her since the previous Friday. And the chief was also suspicious because he kept asking questions and he was getting kind of strange responses to it. For instance, he said that night he was supposed to meet some friends from Kalamazoo at the train depot. But then he couldn't tell the chief what their names were. You know, things like that, just kind of strange, you know. And he claimed that he went straight back to the hospital after that and he hadn't seen her since Friday night. He doesn't know what happened to her. So now they basically had their first two persons of interest, I guess you would probably call them at this point, and they became the two main suspects. There were some other people looked at, but they were the main ones.
How did the media portray this in the initial front page headlines and stories?
Well, it made the front page on, Tuesday morning. In fact, I think even made it on Monday evening late. It was mentioned. But anyway, it was covered on the front pages of San Diego from the, you know, basically from the start. And then the L.A. papers, the major L.A. papers like the L.A. Times and the L.A. Examiner, and there was really about five major papers in L.A. back then, they all started covering it as well. And so it was sensationalized, you know. It was kind of tailor-made for it when you think about it. You had this beautiful young woman, you know, a dancer, exotic dancer, if you will, found scantily clad on the beach under mysterious circumstances. You know, so it's kind of tailor-made for that. And the newspapers then tended, you know, the San Diego papers weren't as bad as some, you know, like the L.A. Examiner or big town yellow newspapers, but they still tended to sensationalize things. You could basically pick any newspaper from that time, and you would find big headlines about murder and mayhem, basically. That's what they, you know, if it bleeds, it leads kind of idea was bigger than it is now. You know, we talk about the bad news now, but that's all you would see on the front pages of those papers, just big screaming headlines. And so the case kind of blew up by degrees. They were interested in it from the beginning. And you know, the thing was is that Fritzi was somewhat known around town from her dancing, so, you know, people kind of knew her. And then, you know, the story blew up from there, just kind of by degrees over the next couple of days, with some Hollywood revelations and, you know, some other things that came out. And then they hyped it. They, you know, and distorted it. And, you know, as it got picked up by countries, newspapers across the country, they tended to distort things even more, you know. The stories get distorted even more every time they're retold, and that's what happened to this story. And the fact that her name was appearing on the front pages along with the death of Wallace Reed, the big actor. And so, you know, once again, it was that Hollywood kind of influence. It was probably the biggest early thing that got the story going.
We didn't mention that during that autopsy there was a discovery, and they called it at the time the delicate condition. And also, to help fuel the story was this information, but also what would be considered in the day a provocative photo of her interpretive dance that she used for promotional purposes.
Yeah, well, the photographs that they published in the newspapers were one of the main things that, you know, kind of, you know, hyped the case. Like I said, some people see these, you know, relatively, I mean, they're not skimpy for today's dancers,
no,
for sure, but back then they were risque. And so, you know, they used all of those photographs on the front pages, and including in L.A. and across the country. And what happened was, is that at the autopsy, it was botched, no question about it. When the coroner delivered her body to this funeral parlor, somehow the word didn't get to, you know, what they then called the undertakers, did not get to him that an autopsy was required. And he immediately started draining the blood from her body to embalm it, you know? And so when the doctor, a Harvard medical graduate named Dr. Shea, he worked for Skylar Kelly, and when he got there, he saw what was happening on the table. He was just shocked, said, you know, why did you do this, basically? And so, you know, that was a problem right there. So he did an autopsy after her blood had been drained. And basically what he determined, the two major things was, he said she had drowned just based on where she was found and the fact that there was this foam coming out of her mouth and some of the other signs of when somebody, one drowns, they typically see at autopsy. Although it's actually one of the hardest things to, you know, diagnose from a forensic perspective. But the other thing was she was 4 to 4.5 months pregnant.
Right.
So you have a beautiful young dancer here, 20 years old, not married. That was a major scandal then, you know, and it really had a lot to do. I mean, it really is at the heart of the story, and what happened to Fritzi was the fact that she got pregnant out of wedlock. And, you know, obviously that scandal, newspapers loved that too. They had to be very careful. They didn't use words like pregnant out of wedlock. They would say a delicate condition, you know, and things like that. She was a victim of her own popularity. You know,
yeah,
they would use
yeah.
these euphemisms. But yeah, that was the biggest thing that came out of there, out of the autopsy.
Now, other than Amelia's suspicion, and there are other people that talk to, Chief Patrick begins to talk to people like Fritzi's friend, Bernice Edwards. But there is, how does Rogers Clark really become a suspect, and how do police not, the police aren't able to find him right away? So tell us about this, trying to find
Rogers Clark. You know, his name came into it, like I said, because Amelia had screamed his name, claimed he had done it, that he had probably gotten her pregnant and then killed her. I mean, that was basically what she alluded to. And he didn't contact the cops, even though it was in the newspaper starting on Tuesday. He didn't think to go to the cops, or he did think, but he just didn't do it. He was actually up in L.A. And the police didn't track him down until Thursday, you know, 3 days into the case, basically. They found him, actually the LAPD found him, staying in a hotel in Los Angeles, and they arrested him and booked him on suspicion of murder. And what was more suspicious about him was the fact that his car, that fancy Marmon sports car, had blood on the back seat. And some of the gauges on the dashboard were smashed. And it looked like his car had maybe run into a rock or something, you know. So it looked like his car looked suspicious. The fact that he didn't contact the police looked suspicious. And at the time they found him and arrested him, it looked like he was about to head back east, back home where he was from, which was New York somewhere. And so all of that looked very suspicious. And then Chief Patrick got on a train, went up to LAPD headquarters, Central, I don't know what they called it then, but and interviewed himself. And he became more suspicious because he gave a couple of people his alibis, including the stepfather of a girl he was dating in San Diego, and that guy immediately said, I don't know what he's talking about. He wasn't here during that time. And then his boss in this little film company he was involved in said that, no, I don't know he was, you know, in the hotel at that time. So his two main alibis wouldn't vouch for him at first. So, you know, at this point, I think Chief Patrick's thinking he's got his guy.
So tell us about these two suspects, and unbeknownst, they're both being looked at very seriously, and this amazing coincidence concerning these two suspects, as you write about.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because they both look guilty, you know. They both had circumstantial evidence against them. The thing about Jacobs was that right around this time at her chum's, Bernice Edwards' house in Long Beach, Fritzy had left behind some correspondence that she had been having with Louis Jacobs, basically the whole time she was up in the L.A. area. And they kind of went back and forth, and clearly they were up to something, which, you know, later determined to be trying to arrange an abortion. That's what was happening. And for various reasons, it didn't happen. And then about 12 days before her death, like maybe 5 days before she left Long Beach to come home, she wrote a telegram giving him, Jacobs, an ultimatum, saying that I've gone through enough, you know, recently, that she was basically going to come to San Diego and stop at nothing, which back then meant she would reveal the scandal. He had gotten her pregnant out of wedlock and refused to marry her, leaving her in basically an impossible situation. And so she was going to cause a scandal, and it would come out that he was trying to arrange an abortion and, you know, that he had gotten her pregnant and the whole bit and refused to marry her, you know, and kind of the moral code then required men to marry him. You know, if you do this, you have to marry the woman, and he refused. So this all came out gradually, starting with the correspondence was the biggest thing. But then, you know, a lot more came out later as well.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to talk about our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. According to Forbes, gyms, nail salons, hotels, mom-and-pop stores, and more are set to go on an epic hiring spree in the coming months to meet the pent-up demand for all of these services. Like you, I was excited to be able to go to see a movie again. I wanted to go see some stand-up comedy. I got to do that, go to the beach, and visit all the small little businesses that I wasn't able to go to during all of this. And all of those businesses reopening means that millions of jobs will need to be filled. So where do these businesses turn to fill these roles fast? ZipRecruiter. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, they send your job to over 100 top job sites, giving you access to their network of millions of job seekers. ZipRecruiter's matching technology scans resumes to find qualified candidates for your open roles and proactively presents them to you. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we were talking about two of seemingly good suspects in this, but this correspondence that they discover is really incriminating despite the language, as you say, to obscure the truth about the abortion itself, the language used, it's pretty evident that they are planning something, as you say, an abortion. Tell us about the Blue Sea Cottage and its role in all of this and how they found out about the Blue Sea Cottage.
Yeah, basically the Blue Sea Cottage was discovered on Wednesday, 2 days after her body was found. And they were, the cops were canvassing all of the places along the beach. She said she was going to Del Mar, and then she said she was going to a party in La Jolla. So those were the main places they were, you know, looking at from the beginning. And one of the cops that was stationed there in La Jolla, you know, was checking all of the beach cottages where tourists, you know, even back then were going then. And he went to one of them. It was called the Blue Sea Cottage. And it was this group of rustic cottages, about 27 of them, that was right near the beach. And, you know, he asked the guy, Albert Kern, the manager, he said, you know, did anybody check in here, you know, on Sunday night, the night she went missing? Basically they found that one young couple had checked in. One was a young man, you know, 28, 30 years old. The other one was a young woman in her 20s. And the manager later identified Fritzi's body. And so they knew it was her. The question was who was the guy? Well, they checked in under assumed names. The name was Mr. and Mrs. Johnston, L.A. So in the cottage where they stayed, you know, they asked Albert Kern what, you know, how long were they here, what happened. Well, he said they apparently only stayed a few hours as far as he could tell. And when the cop went down to the cottage itself, he found that the bed looked like it had just slightly been used. There were some wet towels around. There was some water, you know, remnants of water in the tub in the back. And then there were also some articles like bobby pins and a barrette and that sort of thing. And her mother later identified those as belonging to Fritzi. So there was no question about who the woman was. But, you know, this really was one of the first big breaks in the case for the cops. They found basically what turned out to be crime scene A. You know, it was the first crime scene, if you want to look at it that way. They didn't know that at the beginning, but so, you know, from then on, the hunt was on for the mysterious Mr. Johnston. And, you know, the first question was it Rogers Clark or was it Dr. Jacobs? And basically Albert Kern couldn't identify either one of them. So, you know.
Yeah.
So
tell us when they finally meet up with Clark and then what he has to say.
Yeah, when the LAPD detectives arrested him in Los Angeles, what he originally told them and told Chief Patrick when he got there later was, I haven't seen her since last fall. You know, he had dated her briefly, but he claimed he hadn't seen her since then. He said, you know, she tried to borrow some money from me, I turned her down, and I haven't seen her since. And that was like in early November or something, not long before it turns out Fritzi had gone to L.A. So, you know, and he claimed he didn't know anything about her or anything, but he did happen to be in San Diego that night, the night she went and disappeared,
yeah.
Sunday night. And he and the guy he worked for were staying in this hotel. They had been down in Mexico filming some things, not really sure what they were filming. They were some kind of educational films or something. But this guy's name was Helton that owned this little film company that Clark worked for. And, you know, he basically said, you know, he knew Clark had left that evening to go see somebody, but he didn't see him again until the next morning when he was in the room, you know. So, and then the girl he went to see, it was a young woman again, about 20 or so, that evening, he claimed, her name was Gladys Taylor. She vouched for him and said they had been at this mm-hmm. Golden Lion Tavern, which was a popular place around town. And but her stepfather, who did not like Clark again, you know, I think they all sensed that he was kind of a ladies' man, and whatever you want to call him. Back then, they would call it a sheik, or you know, yeah. Several other slang names they had. But mm-hmm. he basically said, "Yeah, he was here. He picked her up." But then he left early, and so I can't vouch for him during the night, basically. Turns out later he said, no, I guess he was there. And I think he kind of just let the fact that he didn't like Clark color his initial statements. And yeah. And then they basically, he established an alibi, finally, that mm-hmm. Chief Patrick bought, and then the focus was all on Jacobs then.
Yeah. You talk about the fascinating interrogation of Dr. Jacobs by Chief Patrick. What is it he talks about? How does he describe or depict the relationship he has with Fritzy Mann? And what is his role, as he says, about altruism? He considers altruistic intentions. So tell us what he says to police about the relationship and his role in all of it.
Yeah, in one of their interrogations, in fact, the day he was arrested right after this interrogation, which happened on Thursday, they really grilled him this time. They put pressure on him. You know, they were still looking at Clark at this time, but, you know, like I said, he was always suspicious of Jacobs, and he had the correspondence now. So he started giving the correspondence to Jacobs, and Jacobs admitted writing all of them. And basically that he had been there trying to arrange an abortion, which was illegal. You know, even birth control was illegal then. So he admitted all of that, but he claimed that he did it out of damn fool altruism, he said. Basically, yeah. She was a friend. That was it. He never slept with her. He certainly didn't get her pregnant, but she had come to him and asked him to perform an abortion. He refused, but he did want to help her out since they were friends. They were both Jewish. He mentioned that. That was one reason he wanted to help her. And so he gave her money, and he was corresponding her the whole time she was up in L.A., apparently trying and failing to arrange an abortion. And but at the end of it, the chief didn't buy it. He didn't think that there was any way he would be acting the way he was and giving her all this money if he had nothing to do with, you know, her delicate condition, as it were. So yeah. He basically arrested him on suspicion of murder after this interrogation.
Mm-hmm. Now, he was denied bail, and we get to this trial. Tell us a little bit about his defense and really the corpus delicti issue, the big issue.
Yeah, corpus delicti, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but in layman's terms, it basically means, you know, before you can prosecute somebody for a crime, you have to first prove that a crime has been committed. And that was really the big question in the trial, because the defense, headed by a real high-profile lawyer from Los Angeles, contended that she had committed suicide, that she had been depressed. They had people to testify to that. She had plenty of reasons to be depressed, an unmarried woman who was pregnant and a man refusing to marry her. She had plenty of reason, and it was not uncommon for a woman in that situation to take her own life. And so, you know, they tried to prove that it was suicide, the defense. The prosecutor tried to prove that it was first-degree murder, actually, and so that was the big clash. And in the first trial, they barely proved corpus delicti to the judge's satisfaction. But at the end of the trial, the jury didn't buy it. There was a hung trial. They didn't. The disagreement was about had a crime been committed. If she had committed suicide, then there was no crime that Jacobs was responsible for legally, and so they couldn't agree on that. And so that's what happened in the first trial.
What was the response from the media during this? Again, we know that they exaggerate, sensationalize, but what was the depiction there now that they didn't have the narrative of the Hollywood connection? What was the new narrative?
Yeah. The press had lost some interest after, you know, Clark was exonerated and after the first time Jacobs was let go, but then they had a grand jury meet, and then they eventually indicted Jacobs, and he went to trial, and it was like late March. So it was, you know, a couple of months after the crime. And the media started covering it big time again. Across the country, they covered it, you know, even though they hadn't been talking about it a whole lot while until the trial happened. But it was really sensationalized. It was clearly the biggest trial that San Diego had ever seen up to that point. And it was hyped. The main thing was, is that, like I said, you know, was it murder? Was it, you know, the prosecution said that that Jacobs had a clear motive, and he did. You know, he got her pregnant, refused to marry her. He claimed he didn't, but he did. And then refused to marry her, and then she threatened him. So there's motive right there, and that also was not uncommon at the time. You know, it was a motive for suicide for a distraught woman in that situation. It was also motive for murder, and that happened a lot back then. So, you know, the press played up the fact that she was a beautiful young dancer. You know, that's what they always went for, and they played up the fact that Jacobs was this sophisticated doctor from the East. You know, so that was really the narrative there.
Mm-hmm. You write that after that first, when Jacobs was released, 3 hours later, Fritzi was buried in a very small, plain Jewish ceremony, wasn't she?
Yes, that was a week after her body was found on Monday. Jacobs was released from his first arrest, and then they had a very small funeral. It was just a few friends. We don't know exactly who was there, but obviously a very sad affair. And Jacobs didn't go, obviously, even though he claimed to be her good friend. And it was very sad. And I tried to portray that in the book because it was. So
now Jacobs, in this first trial, when he's the verdict is not guilty, he's pretty happy about that, but soon after he realizes the prosecutor is going to retry this case. So
yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Tell us.
It was when they acquitted him, or they didn't acquit him, when there was a hung jury at the first trial, he assumed he'd be let go, but immediately, right away after the trial, basically, the DA, who was a guy named Chester Kempley, who was quite ambitious at the time, said, no, we're taking him to trial again. And so he tried the same thing over again. It was kind of caught up into politics at the time. There was a grand jury investigation going on into corruption and vice, and there was a mayoral campaign that, you know, ended right before the trial, the first trial. And the DA, the newspapers were giving the DA a hard time about not being tough enough on crime. So he couldn't very well just let Jacobs go. At least that's the way he felt. He had to prosecute him. And he wanted to, just for the publicity, if nothing else. But he tried to prosecute him at first-degree murder, and they didn't really have a good scenario of how that happened. So,
and some of the witnesses that you remark about, the prosecution witness, which was the hotel owner who identified the Mr. Johnston, and if this is your prosecution witness, he wasn't effective, and that's an understatement, for the prosecution in this trial, was he?
Yeah, the DA had a horrible star witness. he was very wishy-washy, and you know, you got to remember, this happens in a lot of these kind of famous trials. You know, after, you know, the cops first discovered the cottage, and Albert Kern told his story and described the guy, it sounded a lot like Jacobs, the way he described him, but he refused to identify him one way or the other. And then, you know, after that, basically, a marching band of cops and private eyes and lawyers and newspaper reporters were basically hounding poor Kern. And I think by the time of the trials, he didn't know what he had seen. You know, it was all kind of jumbled up in his mind. But in the second trial, he took the DA by complete surprise by saying, "I'm sure it's not him." Whereas in the first trial, he had said, "I can't say for sure it's him or not. It might be." In the second trial, he says, "I'm sure it's not." And the DA was just really embarrassed in court, and he branded Kern a hostile witness, and then for like the next day and a half of trial time, just tried to get out of him why he had changed his mind. You know, what had changed since the first trial that now you're saying, you know, it's not him? And, you know, Kern claimed that the DA's men, the cops and whatnot, had been really hard on him and given him the third degree and whatnot. And, you know, he said, "They basically put this in my head." And, but he says, "I know it's not him." And so there was nothing the DA could do about it. He later charged him with perjury. And that ended up not going anywhere. But the DA was so embarrassed and so devastated because it basically completely ruined his case. All he had was a strong motive and some circumstantial stuff and a, you know, suspicious defendant, but he didn't have enough to convict him, and so they acquitted him on the second trial.
Let's use this to stop for a second for these commercials. You talk about the acquittal in the second trial, but before that, there's what you write about, and is very, very fascinating, is the press and its role in these trials and these investigations and their status. They had as much status as a district attorney or a police investigator, sometimes being right at the scene, helping to investigate, and in particular in this case as well, that the media's depiction of what was going on and Jacob's dealing with the media and speaking with the media, that there was talk that Jacobs was going to take the stand. And as you write, at that time, someone not taking the stand was considered it not the way it is considered today.
Yes, that's I think correct. Like I said, Chief Patrick was very suspicious of him because he wanted a lawyer, and then the fact that he didn't take a stand made people assume that he was guilty. He had something to hide, and that he wouldn't been able to survive being grilled by the DA. But that was definitely true. But his lawyer never intended to put him on the stand. I think that was all smoke. He just was saying, "I'm willing to go on the stand and tell everything I know." But, you know, he had to hide behind his lawyer and say, "My lawyer's not going to let me take the stand." But yeah, the news media was something. It was, you know, when the police went to the detectives went to the Blue Sea Cottage after it was discovered, they took along this kind of intrepid reporter for the San Diego Sun named Magner White, who became famous the next year for winning the Pulitzer Prize, believe it or not. But he went with him and searched the room with him, and you know, actually found a bottle of what I thought was liquor in the closet, and you know, they didn't secure crime scenes then like they do now. They didn't investigate things as systematically, and you know, chains of custody and all that kind of stuff that they do now. It was just not that way then. San Diego was still, like I said, a relatively small city then. It was one-tenth the size of L.A. And they, you know, they, it just wasn't up to the same standards. And, you know, I don't think you'd have reporters searching the scene with the police now.
Hope not. And, you know, what you write about, too, is this impressive legal team that he had, including his cousin, I believe, or a relative named Louis Shapiro. So a good, experienced legal team that outmanned the the prosecution, which was just two people, two prosecutors, and they had like a six-man or a five-man team. In the first trial, you say that the corpus delicti, the ability for the prosecutor to prove that she drowned, and then why, and then have witnesses. Again, Kern was not a good witness to identify this Mr. Johnston. So what was it in the second trial that really lost that case?
Yeah. Well, like you said, the defense attorney was really high-priced and well-known. Now, Jacobs came from a family that was not well-off. I actually spoke to one of his cousins who was 98 years old at the time when I spoke to her some years ago, and he did not come from a wealthy family. His father had died young, his mother had struggled, but apparently his family, his extended family, chipped in to pay for his defense. And like you said, his cousin, it was either his cousin or his cousin's husband. It's not really clear when you read the stuff back then. But this guy named Shapiro was a well-known attorney in Detroit, and he worked pro bono. And then you had Paul Schenck, who was the leader of the defense team, who was very high priced, was known for defending movie stars and that sort of thing. And then he had three or four other ones, one a former mayor of San Diego who was a lawyer, and a couple of guys who worked for him. And, you know, they always had like five or six people around the defense table, to the point where Jacobs didn't even sit at the table. He was behind all of his attorneys. And then, like you said, they had the DA, and they had an assistant that helped him with the prosecution. But the thing that was different in the second trial, there were a few things. They both had some new witnesses. The defense tried to build an alibi by saying that Jacobs was at this hangout called the Golden Lion. And he frequented this place. And they tried to say that he was there. And they had witnesses, and you know, both sides had witnesses, you know, and it was basically a wash at the end of it. But there was more than enough reasonable doubt. I mean, I agree with the verdict just based on our system. You know, they couldn't prove that she had been murdered, you know, and the manner of death, homicide or suicide, was a question until the very end and beyond. And, in some people's minds, remains a question today.
Mm-hmm. In this book, you write that it took 9 years of research. And you talk about this second trial, and you talk about, and you examine, and you say, based on the evidence that was presented at that trial, they came to the right conclusion. But having looked at this and researched this, there was new evidence that came to you after looking at all of this. And I don't want to give anything away, but Tell us about the circumstances in which you learned about this new evidence, and tell us as much as you can to leave our audience with just even more curiosity.
Okay. Yeah, I started writing it about, about 9 years ago. It took me a long time. The first few years there, I did just tons of research. I had to kind of build it piecemeal, build the story, because, real life is not like a, fiction. You can do whatever you want when you're trying to be accurate, but there's not enough information to write a scene, You have to kind of piece that together, and that's what I did. So it took me a long time, and I kept finding little things. I had the transcript and all the newspaper articles, but a lot of the articles disagreed with each other, and it was hard to tell what was true and what wasn't from some of those. But I got the government documents, some stuff that was not, when I say new evidence, it's not evidence that's definitive or that would stand up in court, but it's mm-hmm. things that were not known by the jury at the time, and apparently not known by the newspaper reporters either. And I got some of it from government documents. It was with Jacob's service in the Army and in the Public Health Service, which is what he did, for the VA hospital. He had transitioned from the Army into the Public Health Service and at the hospital. And I got some of the documents on him. There was, his Army fitness report. There were letters. The Public Health Service was very embarrassed that one of their officers was in the news related to this and was trying to arrange an abortion, which the medical community at the time was very much against. And so they were very embarrassed. So they had their highest official from the San Diego area do an investigation. And he spoke to the DA, he spoke to the people at the hospital and some of the defense attorneys, and then sent a report in to the bigwigs back in Washington. And there were some things revealed in there that the DA knew, but that he couldn't present at trial. Now, would it have made a difference? Probably not. All it did was it strengthened his already strong case, for motive.
mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But it really has a lot to do with what happened to her that night. And, based on these little things, piecing it together, doing a lot of medical research a lot of legal research, too, for that matter. But based on that, I think I know. I know the who, what, where, when, and why of this. Exactly how remains some question to exactly how she died. I'd rather not give away that part of it, but like I said, drowning is one of those things that's very hard to diagnose, and that's true to this day. When you read about it and you talk to pathologists and whatnot, and they say that it's a diagnosis of exclusion, kind of. You rule out various things, and based upon the circumstances, did they drown or not? And she may have drowned. She may have died another way, any of a number of different ways. He may have killed her on purpose, and it may have been an accident. So I'd kind of like to let it go at that. But it's a mystery up until the very, very end, so...
You also leave, I guess I'll just throw this out too, you also leave another question in terms also as well as this doctor may have known more about the procedures regarding abortion than possibly anyone would have known.
Yeah, during his residency, he had done some training in what they called the genitourinary clinic, what was then called Hebrew Hospital, which later I think became Johns Hopkins, or it was associated with Johns Hopkins or whatever in Baltimore. But he had done a lot of training there, and presumably he may have witnessed childbirths, he may have witnessed or taken part in abortions. It's hard to say. He didn't want to perform an abortion on Fritzy, but he may have had the requisite knowledge to do it. Obviously, it would have been very risky to do that outside of a hospital, but... and also, he said some things during the trial to a reporter, and he was talking about twilight sleep, which was kind of a controversial thing back then, and it was this mixture that they sometimes use for childbirth for pain. It was scopolamine and morphine, a mixture of those two substances, and apparently you would still be awake, but you wouldn't feel any pain, and you wouldn't really remember the childbirth or the pain afterwards. And he mentioned that because he said, he told the reporter that the DA wanted to give him truth serum, you know, and he said, I'd be happy to do that, but that stuff is no good. And he mentioned this twilight sleep thing, which, you know, somebody who's thinking about, well, did he get involved in this directly? Well, it sounds to me like he might have had the knowledge to do it anyway. So,
as you say, we'll leave so much for the reader to discover, but also that you put the circumstantial case together very much like a prosecutor or an investigator, and so that's what the reader will have, your conclusions, putting these circumstantial evidence together to be able to paint an even more disturbing picture than we already have. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about your book, Mystery at the Blue Sea Cottage, A True Story of Murder in San Diego's Jazz Age. James Stewart, is there? I know this is a Wild Blue Press release. Can you tell us where they might find out more about this? Is there a Facebook page, website? Tell us more.
Oh, yeah, I'm on all the social media. Wild Blue Press has a page, and I've got a website, and I've got a page on there. I've got my own website. It's called jamesstewartauthor.com, just all one word. And I'm on Facebook. I'm on Pinterest and Twitter and, you know, the usual stuff. And, you know, the book is available on Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble. And some other places, so it won't be hard to find.
Absolutely. It's been a fascinating talk with you. James, thank you so much. Mystery at the Blue Sea Cottage. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
have a
Dan.
Great evening.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Good night.
Night.